This time on Gamers Week Podcast.
My favorite Street Fighter character also happens to be my first video game crush as a kid.
Okay.
And that, of course, is Cammy.
Right? You paused long enough. I had some things in mind and I figured you were going Cammy, but I just wanted to be sure.
And that turned me into, you know, my preferences in regards to just, you know, the aesthetic I was looking for out of the ladies. And it started.
Blondes?
No, it's not about the blonde part. It's something else, but.
The beret.
Yes, the beret.
The beret, of course. What was I thinking? Right.
I mean, I go to France and I can't help myself, right? Everybody's in a beret. I cannot do a good Bill Murray impression. I've always wanted to, but that's one just it eludes me. Except for like, what is it? Earl Spackler, where he's there.
Cinderella boy.
Right. It's in the hole.
He's going to use about a 9-iron.
Sitting at Augusta.
Cinderella boy.
What's great about this is you can play 36 holes on it and then just go home and get stoned to the bejesus off of it.
You guys want to keep going or you want to get started?
Let's get started.
All right. Welcome to Gamers Week Podcast. Like the name says, we analyze the best, worst, and weirdest headlines of the past week in the video game industry. This is episode 10, and today is Wednesday, February 23rd, 2022. Welcome, everyone, and thanks for tuning in. My name is Blue Williams, and I'll be your host for this evening. I have with me my two co-hosts. They're the reason the milkshake machine is usually broken at McDonald's. I have Ryan Payne, a.k.a. Professor Ryebread, a.k.a. Ruan, a.k.a. Retro Game Brews, a.k.a. I don't... What other names have I missed?
That's good enough for me, I think.
That's good. There's too many for me to remember. And then we also have the one and only Donnie G. How are you guys tonight?
Looking forward to people going to McDonald's and when they tell them that the ice cream machine isn't working instead of Newman from,
hello, from Newman.
Seinfeld, they're going to be like, Donnie and Ryan!
Yep.
I'm a man who loves a good milkshake. I'm not going to lie. But recently with my a change in diet, it's going to be a killer. I know I'm going to be craving them and I cannot have them.
So you have to give up the milkshake so that your milkshake will bring the boys to the yard.
That went dark.
That was a great joke. I'm gonna applaud. Okay.
Thank you. I don't need pity applause, but I'll take it. All right, let's get this show started with our reviews, reactions, and requests. Ryan, will you take these?
Gladly. So let's start off with SMB Flurry says, love the podcast and the art of fighting was such a Street Fighter ripoff.
Yes.
That Capcom made the character Dan as a parody of Art of Fighting's main character, Ryo. SB Poseidon said, listening to Gamers Week podcast and their discussion about the Halo show royalty issue, I have to say I watched Red versus Blue for years, so I think I will be okay with new music. I also watched a lot of Red versus Blue, and I think I probably quit after the third season, but still, great, great series. If you haven't checked it out, I highly recommend it. And CHM13 says, these folks nailed it with their podcast format and host talent. I listen to dozens of podcasts of varying quality daily and work behind the scenes on a few also varying quality. I'm super impressed on how good this show is from the start. Well done. Keep it up. Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. That was kind.
Yes. We each can be contacted for our individual booking rates on your podcast. If you'd like. And now it's time for the
very important poll.
Oh my God, Gizmo's here.
My
Wow.
Or was that the jackalope? I'm trying to decipher.
Ask me. You'll never catch me.
Jackalope it is.
The bar is really getting high for these. I don't know, right? I don't know how to top any of that.
Next thing, it's going to be like a whole Broadway musical song and dance for the introduction of the very important poll.
And I'm assuming that I'm going to be assigned this next week. Thank you so much for setting me up.
I'm never going to do it again. That's basically what it comes down to. But you were in the, you were in show choir, Ryan. So you seem like
Donnie was in choir. He was in choir.
Yes, but you were in show choir.
You were in show choir.
There's no dancing involved in it. This is an audio only podcast.
See Ryan dance around. My little buttercup has the sweetest smile.
Smile. God, I love that song.
Every Monday on Twitter, we post our VIP, very important poll. If you'd like to participate, follow us on Twitter at GamersWeekPC. So the question for this week was, Street Fighter VI is coming out. So it begs the question, who is your all-time favorite Street Fighter character? Coming in at the top, of course, you know it, I know it, our winner, Ryu. At 40.5% of the vote. Coming in second, Chun-Li, 28.7%. She does have the fast legs. Other got 24.7%. And Sagat, who I thought might have gotten more than this, only got 6.1% of the vote. So let's look at some of the answers from the other category. At You Fall Before Me, can't go wrong with the basic Ryu Ken combo. So easy to pick up for beginners, but also very well-rounded. Their styles are so easy and good, yet not quite similar. Even Daigo Umehara, the FGC beast himself, still remains Ryu at Evo to this day. At Duct Tape Play says, Vega Claw. I suck as him, but he'll always be my favorite.
Nice.
I think it's basically the aesthetic, right? And how fast he moves?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
And at Bogus Meat Factory says two words, Dan Hibiki. You love a good underdog. Cocky, perceived to be lowest tier, but always surprises you. At Ragdoll Catman says, gotta be Blanka, though Chun-Li and Guile are good too. And at Emo-esque underscore IWL says, any Soul Calibur character, smiley face. Way to go, Emo.
Troll in the dungeon.
We got a troll! So definitely a wide variety of characters that you can pick. It's nice to see that most of these choices are from the original Street Fighter, because how can you go wrong with those tried and true characters?
Absolutely. When it comes down to it, I think that some of the newer characters, while interesting, and they've got a lot of interesting backstories and stuff, it's not like they stray too far from the formula anyway. Right. So it makes sense that a lot of folks chose some of the originals.
Now, one of my choices was Sagat. He is one of my favorites because he takes Ryu and Ken, and he kind of steps it up a notch because he's a little bit quicker, in my opinion. So he's taller, he's quicker, he can do the fireballs down below as well as up top. So to me, that makes him more dynamic than what Ryu and Ken do.
That's not what you answered with the poll, though.
That's not? What did I answer? Oh, no. Oh, my God. Okay, I need to redo that. I completely forgot about that.
No, just go from here. Just say it.
So I forgot about this. One of my favorite characters in Street Fighter is Shang Long. And only one person actually called me out on this and saw that I was trolling. Now, if you don't know the history of Shang Long, he was a character that was created in one of the April Fool's episodes of, I believe it was Electronic Gaming Monthly. So every April, they would have this issue that came out that was just totally off the wall with different things. And one of them was saying how you could unlock Shang Long in the SNES port of Street Fighter II. And people just rushed. They believed it. They bought it. They tried hard as hell to unlock it. Nobody ever could. And it finally came out from Electronic Gaming Monthly that this was a hoax. There was never a character named Shang Long. It was taken from one of the things that was said by Ryu whenever you got defeated by him. And it said, you have to defeat Shang Long in order to beat to be the master or something like that, or you have to beat Shoryuken. I don't remember which one it said, but it did reference Shenlong, and it just drove people crazy. So Shenlong is not a real character. I kind of threw a troll thing out there, and only one person caught that.
I still believe in Shenlong. He's out there. We just haven't found him yet.
Right. Wouldn't it be awesome if they brought him out for Street Fighter VI?
Oh, that would be cool. Yes. Capcom, do it for real.
Now, I did read a little bit of lore, and I think the Shenlong character basically in some way, shape, or form did make his way into some of the later revisions of Street Fighter with Goku or whoever it was that Akuma. I think there was a little bit of Akuma or a little bit of Shenlong that was in Akuma. So I'd have to read up on my Street Fighter history to really speak intelligently about that.
Mm-hmm. But this was a nice mini episode of Professor Rye Bread.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Just un poquito.
Professor Donnie's quick hits.
I'm in there and I'm quick and I'm out. Bam, I'm done.
Okay.
So, Blue, who did you pick for your choice?
I picked Chun-Li. Even today, if I'm playing a video game and there's an option to play as a female character, then I'm going to choose the female character. Chun-Li is my girl, which means that it's all the more heartbreaking that she got that horrible Street Fighter movie back in 2009, The Legend of Chun-Li, starring Kristen Kruk or Kruk or however you say her last Kristen name. Kruk. But that is got to be on my list of top 10 worst movies I have ever seen.
Never saw it.
Yeah, I've heard about it so much that I have not seen it.
It's got to be enjoyable if you have enough substances with you, but yeah.
Patron-only movie night?
Maybe, what? I don't know.
That or the original Street Fighter?
No, this 2009 one is way worse than the original Street Fighter movie.
Now, I had a thing for Kristen Kruk whenever she was on Smallville, and then when I saw that she was cast as Chun-Li, I was just like, no, I don't believe that at all.
Yeah, but it wasn't just her. It was pretty much everybody cast in the movie, and the writing is so bad.
If I can catch it somewhere for free and I don't have to pay for it, sure, I might give it a watch.
Mm. Well, you've been warned.
Ryan, who did you go with?
So you guys went with characters that you actually played with, but we're talking about favorite. So if we're talking about characters I played with, I main Zangief when I play. Guy's got pretty easy moves, except for like his swirling pile driver, where it requires you to go all the way around the D-pad twice. But my favorite Street Fighter character also happens to be my first video game crush as a kid.
Okay.
And that, of course, is Cammy.
Right? You paused long enough. I had some things in mind, and I figured you were going Cammy, but I just wanted to be sure.
And that turned me into, you know, my preferences in regards to just, you know, the aesthetic I was looking for out of the ladies. And it started
blondes.
No, it's not about the blonde part. It's something else. But
the beret.
Yes, the beret. The beret,
of course. What was I thinking? Right.
I mean, I go to France and I can't help myself, right? Everybody's in a beret. So Cammy has always been, you know, my favorite Street Fighter character for that. And what I like about it is, too, she's got a cool backstory, right? She used to be part of Bison's group. Then she kind of split off from that. And then she was played by Kylie Minogue, which I had a crush on back then, too, in Street Fighter, the movie. So it all kind of lined up in the universe for Ryan.
Nice.
Interesting. I mean, I think you're not alone. You are not alone. When you say that Cammy was one of your crushes, because I think I definitely had a crush on her too. I have a drawing that I did of her back when I was younger. Not in any.
Please post it. Please.
If I can find it, I will.
Please.
I will put it in the Discord. So if you're not a patron of the show. And you want to see this drawing, guess what? You can become a patron and actually see what I've done a long time ago.
How old were you?
Oh, what was I, 14?
Hmm.
It's a good drawing. It's a good drawing. I was a good artist.
I'm looking forward to
this. Like a stick figure, Cammy.
Just a green
stick. She probably has the figure. Proper number of fingers and things like that.
I'll post it.
Looking forward to it. All right, now let's move on to our patron shout outs. Oh, shoot. I forgot to reword this.
Way to go.
How about just here are the gorgeous folks supporting Gamers Week on Patreon?
Gorgeous.
Oh, generous. Yes, that's the word. Gorgeous George.
Marvelous people.
There we go.
Okay.
Let's do it.
We could tweak it again next week if we don't like it. All right. We couldn't do what we do without the help of our patrons. Here are the generous folks supporting Gamers Week on Patreon. Sheriff Snacks, Frank Grande, Producer BTW, Steven Sand, Terry Kinnair, Ducks in Disguise, Jim and Colleen, Games with Coffee, Davey PGH, the Red Ox PDX family, including Shannon and Luke, Zach Huge Thanks, Random Retro Dude, Michael Lundin, Princess Kitty Mew Mew, Mega Retro Man, Emo Esque, Rybread's number one fan, Fruitcake's number one stan, The Wizard of Zardoz, Clayman 71, Great Saiyaman 81, BNT Zelligai, and Crunchy Kong. If you like what you hear today, and we really hope you do, please consider joining us on Patreon. Your support helps cover the cost of producing the show, as well as other cool stuff we'll be doing, like prizes and giveaways. You'll also gain access to our weekly patron-only bonus cast called Gamers Week Uncut, Patrons with Benefits. Visit patreon.com/gamersweek or follow the link in the show notes to learn more.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. All right, let's move on to our headlines.
All right, this one is funny, and I'm really looking forward to this, but from Eurogamer, Street Fighter VI logo looks like an Adobe stock image, and its creator wants a cut. The new logo for Street Fighter VI has caused quite a stir online, with many likening it to an $80 stock image found on Adobe. Now, the creator of said stock image has offered to sell the exclusive rights to their design to Capcom. Adobe image creator XCoolie spoke to IGN about their logo being used, in quotations, by Capcom and shared they were looking to sell exclusive rights for the image to Capcom, removing it from sale to other parties. There is, of course, a chance that Capcom's new logo, bearing a striking similarity to XCoolie's Adobe stock image, is just a coincidence. But even if that does turn out to be the case, the new logo for Street Fighter VI hasn't exactly won itself scores of fans. Many have lamented the fact that Capcom has chosen to shun the once vibrant and martial arts-inspired Street Fighter logos of the past for something that is, well, boring. The new logo is just generic, and if you look hard enough, you will see it pretty much everywhere. For example, it bears a striking resemblance to the logo of a sci-fi convention in France and the NFT symbol. This maybe wasn't the reaction Capcom was hoping for when it announced Street Fighter VI to the world, but there is no denying it has certainly got people talking.
Way to go, Capcom. You swung and you missed.
I mean, is Capcom in trouble, like, financially? That they have to resort to, like, they don't have an art staff anymore. They just said, go get that $80 stock image and we'll tweak it a little bit and then we'll call it good. Like, how much trouble is Capcom in that they're having to resort to doing that?
Right.
I'm just imagining some guy who is really behind on his work. You know, something's going on at home. Like, he's, you know, maybe he put a lot of money down on the Super Bowl and picked the wrong one. And now he's scrambling on something to do. And then last minute he goes, oh, my God, the logo's due tomorrow. So he just looked up things like SF logo and then threw it into Google Images and just went, oh, okay, this one looks good. And threw a six on the bottom of it and was like, oh, got it in before the deadline. Of course, they're going to give me a hard time about it, but at least I got something. And then all right. The execs at the meeting were like, that looks great.
Right.
It's like a kid who's had an entire year to work on his science project. And we
exactly.
The night before, he's like, oh, no.
Puts together like something that looks similar to a yo-yo and goes, hey guys, look, gravity.
Who told you about my science project?
Busted.
In all seriousness, to me, it looks like a logo designed by committee.
Right.
Maybe the Adobe stock image is just a coincidence, but it does kind of look like the kind of logo that had input from too many people who don't understand design. So, that's why it looks so boring with the little six on the bottom. I've heard several people online say that it looks like Street Fighter has six messages because it kind of looks that little notification like you get on your email or you get on Twitter or something. I don't know what they were thinking, but hopefully they do something better before they release the actual game.
I mean, this looks like a turd. It looks like a turd.
Absolutely.
You look at all the other logos that Street Fighter has had, and there has been that iconic Street Fighter lettering, that splash lettering that we've had since Street Fighter 2. I mean, I understand that you want to change some things up, but change something up with that, you know, with still have the Street Fighter your text or what have you, but do something else differently, not just put it in a box and say, oh, SF, there you go. Let's just focus more in the game and not on the logo, because people are going to buy it anyway, right?
Well, actually, that brings up a good point. Does the lack of attention to detail on this logo make you a little bit concerned for what the game might be like?
A little more than a little concerned.
I'd have to see what the gameplay looks like and what the characters look like as well.
There's also part of me that wonders, is this a genius marketing plan? Because we're all talking about it, right?
Did Street Fighter VI need a genius marketing plan?
Well, maybe it's like, all right, well, this franchise has been out for a long time. Maybe people have forgotten about it. Doubt it. But the thought process comes to me as like the Sonic movie. When that first came out and everybody went like, oh my God, it looks so awful. They were like, hey, why don't we do one of those where we're going to send out one that looks like it's super generic, and then we'll come back with a better one, and then people will be really interested in checking out Street Fighter VI. If that's the case, kudos to you, marketing team.
That's brilliant.
Is it?
It is brilliant. And that's the hill I'm going to die
on. All it's done is undermine our faith in that we had in Capcom to be able to give us the sequel we've been waiting for.
Unintended consequences. I am nervous if we're mailing it in with the logo. What else are we mailing it in?
Right. Did we get a release date on this?
Ooh, I don't know.
I don't think they did. Enhance.
Enhance.
No release date yet. Okay, yeah.
It's expected in Q3 of 2022.
That doesn't mean anything.
Nope.
Right. Silk Song.
Oh, God, why?
From Engadget, Call of Duty might take a year off in 2023.
What? Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
You might be waiting a while for the next big Call of Duty game after this year. Bloomberg sources claim Activision is delaying the 2023 Call of Duty release after Vanguard failed to meet sales targets. Oh, I wonder why. Executives reportedly fear they're releasing games in the franchise too quickly, and that Black Ops Cold War may have eaten some demand for the newer title. The free-to-play Warzone might also have affected sales of the paid releases. The delay isn't connected to Microsoft's purchase of Activision, according to the tipsters. That deal isn't expected to close until 2023. The publisher didn't confirm or deny the delay in a statement to Bloomberg. Instead, the spokesman promised an exciting slate of paid and free Call of Duty experiences for 2022, 2023, and the years ahead. The rumored delay comes as Ubisoft is said to be converting an Assassin's Creed Valhalla expansion into DLC, as it looks to fill a void between Valhalla itself and in the online-oriented Infinity. While the circumstances behind the shifting schedules are different, there's a common element. Both major publishers are struggling to maintain the annual release schedules for their significant franchises. There's no guarantee the companies will slow their releases from this day forward, but they may not be quite as predictable as in years past. I think this is an interesting topic because I personally think that they are churning these games out just too rapidly. In all honesty, there's nothing different from a Call of Duty multiplayer to the next Call of Duty multiplayer. All you're changing is the stupid environment.
So I'm looking at a list of Call of Duty games, the main series games. Okay. And from 2003 to this year, 2022, the only year that did not have a release of Call of Duty was 2004.
Wow.
So they have done one every year since 2005.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Donnie, how many of you played, would you say, in the franchise? Are you somebody who does it every single year, or are you somebody who skipped around a few?
I've skipped around a few. And actually, I think Treyarch is going to be the company that comes out with the next one. I despise anything that Treyarch does. I have skipped everything that Treyarch has touched. I played Black Ops 2, and I wasn't really a fan of it because it felt like it was more sluggish. And Treyarch likes to do the whole World War II motif thing. And it just, I have been inundated with World War II shooters ever since I started playing first-person shooters, which was back in the mid-90s. I can't stand them.
And from the point of view of somebody who's into Call of Duty, do you think if they skipped a year, it would have a drastic effect on the player base and their adoption of potential future stuff?
Maybe. Another company could come out with another game, another first-person shooter game, and then that would they would grab like, well, this is old news. Call of Duty is just the same old Call of Duty. They're not putting anything out. I'm going to go try this game for a little bit. Now, granted, that other game that they try could suck completely. And then they would come back to playing Call of Duty. But Call of Duty could totally skip a year or two and just kind of release DLC, maybe some new maps like they've done in the past. They've like for multiplayer, they've released maps sparingly, and which has kept people coming back to the game. Now, when you have the free to play Warzone, I think more people are playing that as opposed to traditional multiplayer. I could be wrong on that one, but it seems like more people are playing the free to play Warzone as opposed to the pay for it multiplayer.
Right. And that's what I was going to say is in our house, Mr. Blue has been an enormous Call of Duty fan since the beginning. We buy every game every year with all the additional map packs and all of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. When the games are ported forward, he rebuys them so he can continue to play them on the current console. And that happened all the way up until Warzone last year. And then I think really what is happening is the series is just a victim of now of Warzone's success, because it has been so good and enjoyed by so many people that there really doesn't seem any reason to go on and get the new games. Like Mr. Blue did buy Black Ops Cold War and barely touched it. And then he didn't bother buying Vanguard. So Vanguard is the first one that we didn't buy.
Okay.
And I think it's all completely due to Warzone.
Well, I guess then what's the difference as far as appeal then between free-to-play Warzone versus the mainstay Call of Duty franchise, you know, entries?
When you're talking about the regular, the single player campaign, you don't get the story that game tells. You kind of get a little bit of a story with the different seasons that come out, like season one, season two, season three of Warzone. It gives you a little, like maybe 2 to 5 minute video in between letting you know things that how things are progressing, but that's it. And maybe that's kind of all you need. And you don't need to spend $69 or $59 on a base game that you're just playing to learn the story and then to go on and play multiplayer.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the thing is depending on what kind of gamer you are, I suppose, a lot of people like the campaigns and a lot of people just don't even bother with them. The longevity of Call of Duty is in the online multiplayer. And if Warzone gives you that for free and it's really, really good, then that's really just all people wanted.
Yep. Just give me the ability to download new maps. Download the new maps, download the new weapons, and just keep going like that.
Yeah, I actually think this is where there's a little bit of similarity with Mario Kart, because as much as I love Mario Kart, if you didn't have the ability to go to online lobbies, then I'd have stopped playing it quite a while ago.
Right.
It's the same thing with me when it comes to Splatoon. I have not played the campaign past like the first level. As far as things go. And I even bought the extra levels because why not? Haven't even touched them as far as
that would be why not.
Right. because the online experience is so much more fun than me going through different levels and hopping, you know, almost basically doing platforming as part of it. When the online, there's so much variety to it, especially if you want to go into ranked games. So I get it. I'm totally on board with that as well.
Next up from GameSpot, Uncharted movie passes 100 million as Sony calls it a franchise. Sony's Uncharted movie opened in the US on February 18th, following its release in the UK and other parts of the world earlier in the month. And the Tom Holland, Mark Wahlberg action film has now made more than 139 million worldwide. Success at that level was enough to give Sony Pictures CEO Tom Rothman the confidence to say Uncharted is now a franchise for the film company going forward. As such, viewers should probably expect a sequel, though the company has yet to flat out confirm this. Uncharted cost $120 million to produce, and that doesn't count marketing expenses. But Rothman said in an email to staff obtained by Deadline that Uncharted is a new hit movie franchise for the company. The executive also mentioned how Uncharted has a very, very positive 90% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, although the aggregate review score from critics was much lower by some measures. On the heels of Venom, Let There Be Carnage, Ghostbusters Afterlife, and Spider-Man No Way Home, Uncharted is yet another blow to the theatrical naysayers and further proof of the efficacy of our model, the executive said.
You're going to claim that a net gain of $19 million is enough to call this a franchise?
Well, and that's not factoring in marketing expenses either.
Right. Have any of you seen this movie yet?
I haven't, but heard from Frank Grande, one of our patrons, that it wasn't bad. It was a decent movie. Didn't say it was like the best movie ever seen in his life, but he enjoyed it.
Blue, what about you?
No, honestly, I wasn't looking into it.
You don't have a lot of faith on this adaptation?
Not really. Which is, you know, speaking, of course, I haven't seen it. It feels like it should be an absolute slam dunk because the Uncharted games are practically movies already.
Right, right, right.
Mm-hmm. So the fact that it has lower critical review scores, makes me go, what did they do?
I've seen some kind of hubbub about the Uncharted movie and how it was just kind of, it wasn't great. I'm looking forward to seeing it. However, I'm not enthusiastic about it. And I haven't been ever since they announced that Mark Wahlberg, a.k.a. Mr. Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch, was going to play Sully.
You mean the guy who ends every sentence with like a high pitch? Like, how's it going? Yeah. Let's yeah.
Say how you doing.
What we're going to do.
And you just sound like Yogi Bear.
Hey, boo-boo.
Yep.
I find it interesting that when it was announced that Tom Holland was going to be Nathan Drake, that was the big hubbub. And now everybody's like, that'll work, I guess. But that Mark Wahlberg guy, we won't stand for this.
Screw that guy.
So the one thing I think that everybody is, of course, and we've mentioned this earlier, but is this idea of calling something a franchise far too early into its success. I mean, how long has this been out? You said February 18th is when this came out. So we're talking
a week,
right? And we're already calling it. Now, granted, you've made your money back for the most part in a week. Great, grand. But when you talk about this idea of franchises, we're usually talking about movies that are typically on their second one, potentially under their third one, in which we start considering them to be a franchise. So are we already claiming that this is going to be a successful second and third movie the first week that this comes out? Aren't we kind of putting the cart in front of the horse a little bit on this one?
We may as well call it what it is. Sony started planning this Uncharted movie, fully intending to make as many as they possibly could out of it. So in their minds, it is a franchise, even if we only have the one movie so far. The question is, how much money would they have to lose before they would cancel the rest of them?
I don't know. Look at Resident Evil. Look at that franchise. Look at how much money that franchise has lost. And they still continue to pump them out.
Yeah. I don't know why.
I've seen two Resident Evil movies, and that was one too many. The original one I saw back in the theaters, and I was like, okay, you know, it's not terrible.
It wasn't good.
No, it wasn't good. It wasn't great. And then the second one came out, and I'm just like, no, this is just too over the top. Nope, I'm out. Yeah, I haven't seen one since.
After this, I'm out.
I don't know what the heck just happened, but I don't really care because I'm going to get the out of here.
But you know, we're going to talk more about movies later on in our main topic. So
no way.
So maybe we should put this on hold and go on to our next one.
Roger, putting on a hold.
Roger over. That's Clarence over.
Dunn was over Unger and I was under Dunn.
All right, next up from Games Radar, U.S. game reseller discovers hundreds of rare sealed games in old storage facility. Ooh.
Does that make you guys tingly?
No, it would make me tingly if I was said person, but yes. Chances are this person knows what they're worth. Covering 80s and 90s consoles released on Nintendo's Super Nintendo, Sega, Sega CD, Genesis, Saturn, and the 3DO, the vast collection was put in storage following the closure of a local game store in 1994.
Wow.
In something of a games reseller's dream, Nebraska-based Game Room discovered the collection, which is comprised of everything from pristine copies of extremely rare games like Final Fantasy III and Chrono Trigger to somewhat less desirable deluge of annual sports games. Understandably, Game Room stated that it won't be posting any guesses alluding to the value of the collection, sensibly opting to wait until their newly acquired stock has been professionally valued and preserved. Oh, Wada. Still, if you take a quick look at eBay or use U.S. retro game evaluation site price charting, it's not hard to imagine what the value of this vast library reaching the tens of thousands of dollars. Other notable games hidden away were the ridiculously rare, I don't know if I would agree with this, Sunset Riders, valued around $750, and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 4, Turtles in Time, which is valued around $1,400.
Is that true?
Yes, it's true.
Sealed.
Okay, I was like, I have a loose copy of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 4 that I will totally sell for $1,400. Hell, I'll give you a deal and sell it for $1,300.
It's like those Yahoo articles are like, you could be having a fortune sitting away in your closet right now. A copy of TNC Stirp Designs is going for $43,000.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's what I think leads a lot of these people. It's articles like this that lead people to put listings up on Marketplace and Craigslist and whatnot of like, oh, I got my Nintendo with a Super Mario Brothers and a Duck Hunt, man. I want $1,300 for this. It's a model 001. I know what 001. I got. 001.
I remember there was a Storage Rollers episode where a guy was like, oh, look, I got the model 001. I was like, dude, that is the most common. That's the toaster, man.
The 001 is what defines the actual Nintendo Entertainment System. Then there's the 002, which I guess is the Zapper or some shit like that.
Yep. Now, most of the time when you hear about stuff like this, it was someone's private collection that they put up in a storage room and then, you know, someone else found it because they didn't pay for it. This is from a store, which I think even makes it cooler, because what's going to happen is that there's going to be some prominence to selling these games in particular. The unfortunate part is what likely is going to happen is that WADA is going to get their hands on it. And similar to what they've done with other collections that were popular or public or well-known, like the Carolina collection was one example of that, whereas one guy's like treasure trove of games, they'll add an extra value to it because it's associated with a popular collection, which is unfortunate. And you know that the way the market goes, this person, or what is it, Game Room, probably knows that putting this in a WADA case or a VGC case is going to up the value of it exponentially for them anyway. So in a way, if they're really looking to make money off of this, it would be foolhardy for them not to do it, right?
True.
See, I was going to offer a question to the group. Would you open the sealed copy to play? I know you wouldn't, because you don't even open your toys to play with them.
Hey, leave my toys out of this, okay?
But Ryan, would you open and play games that you bought from this?
So I have been known to do that. I've had a few games in which I have opened that would have been sealed. I had a copy of Wario Woods for the NES, which, by the way, is the last ever officially released NES game, was Wario Woods. I had a copy that I opened for that. It's probably should have stayed sealed because it's a terrible game. I had a copy of Dragon Quest 7 and 8 that I opened up, which are fantastic games. So glad I went with that. But there's part of me that likes the idea that this was from a store from 1994 that maybe doesn't deserve to be touched in that sense. If it's not somebody's private collection where somebody was just hoarding it because they knew they could get value out of it, I'd be much more apt to open up a sealed game like that, where this is kind of just like a blast from the past. It hasn't been touched since 1994.
And who are you? Who are you to open it up and be the one to actually touch it?
Right.
I would totally open it up. If I buy a game, I'm going to play it.
Oh, absolutely.
And 99% of the time, that's true for me.
Even if I had the money to pick up that sealed Chrono Trigger, I'm opening it up and I'm playing it.
But most of these games that you can play on emulation. So if you're looking at this strictly from an investment standpoint, I can go and play Chrono Trigger all day long on my emulator. But this is, in my opinion, it's like a once in a lifetime thing to find a sealed copy that's probably pristine if it's been sitting in a box for 20 plus years.
I guess I wouldn't be looking at it as investment. I would be looking at it purely as enjoyment.
And I think that depends on what kind of collector you are. Are you somebody who's collecting to play them? Are you somebody who's collecting to make them look pretty on a shelf? Are you somebody who's collecting to invest in your future? Or are you some combination of all of them?
Mm-hmm. All three. That's me.
I like rare stuff because there's a part of it that's like, wow, I get to play something.
You that like not the a flex. Lot of people.
Not necessarily the flex. The idea that...
You like the flex.
There's part of the flex, but the point being is that, like, if you own something that's extremely rare, most people have never experienced this. So I get to experience something that not most people have, you know? But most of the time, if it's not a good game, I don't want to keep it. What I like to do is typically go to like a retro store, especially a local one, not like a GameStop, and trade them in to find other stuff I actually will play. Because that, again, I'm helping out a small business. I'm potentially helping put that in the hands of somebody who might enjoy it from a nostalgic perspective. And I'm getting stuff that I didn't want to pay for because I got a lot for, you know, $50 that included a whole bunch of games that I can get way more credit on.
Okay. All right, let's move on to our top three new releases for the week.
Destiny 2, The Witch Queen. Platform, PS5, Xbox Series X and S, PS4, Xbox One, Stadia, and PC. Delve into Savathun's throne world to uncover the mystery of how she and her Lucent Hive stole the light. Learn the secrets to crafting new weapons, the new glaive, and survive the truth within her web of lies. Soul Cresta, PS4. Switch and PC. Rise like the phoenix and take back the sun. Neoclassic shooting strikes back. Dock, split, and form up. Pilot three fighters and take back the sun from the clutches of evil in this free-form shooting game with the spirit of 80s shooting classics, Moon Cresta and Terra Cresta. UN Squadron, anyone? Elden Ring. Platform, PS5, Xbox Series X and S, PS4, Xbox One, and PC. Rise, tarnished, and be guided by grace to brandish the power of the Elden Ring and become an Elden Lord in the Lands Between. A vast world where open fields with a variety of situations and huge dungeons with complex and three-dimensional designs are seamlessly connected. As you explore, the joy of discovering unknown and overwhelming threats await you, leading to a high sense of accomplishment. I know which one of this list Blue is probably excited for. Was that a squee?
That was a squee. I've had this pre-ordered for a while, and it's supposed to get here on Friday, and God help me if it is late.
It's like you don't have anything else to play.
I know, but I am so hyped to play this. A Soulsborne game in an open world. Those are two things that I love. It's like it was made for me, and I cannot wait to play this.
Now, just so everyone knows, Blue is going to be taking a 2-week hiatus from the podcast.
Yeah, I'll be back in, I don't know, 3 or 4 months, whatever.
You're going to see a dip in quality because it's just me and Donnie and we don't know how to edit the podcast. So just bear with us is all I'm saying.
But what are you guys thinking of? And Donnie, I know you're not a Destiny player and I don't think you are either, Ryan.
Nope.
Never have, never will.
So are you heading to Soul Cresta?
Yes. So I have played a butt ton of Terra Cresta. So the arcade that I used to go to when I lived in Nashville was one of those ones where you pay them $12 for the day and you can play whatever you want. Terra Cresta was definitely a game that I've played a lot of. Never played Moon Cresta. I'm thinking that one was actually an earlier version of it, but just... You know, try to think of maybe what like Jackal looks like from like a perspective where it's like a lot of dirt and earth and stuff. And then put a fighter ship over top of that. And it is a lot of fun. And it sounds like they're kind of sticking to the formula for this. So I'm pretty excited. This is going to be awesome.
I had not heard of Sol Cresta before, but taking a look at some of the screenshots, it does look like an interesting top-down fighter or shmup. So I think I'm going to rock that one.
The fact that it's coming to Switch as well is also really helpful for me. That's the console I play most of the time anyway. So it's the only one I've got set up on my TV downstairs. So.
I think I'm becoming a Switch person more and more. I mean, I've been playing a lot of Mario Kart lately, but sitting down on a console anymore, and my consoles are downstairs in our basement. I just don't want to I don't want to go all the way downstairs and hook up a console and play something. I'd rather it play on my Switch. So now most of these games that come out are coming out on the Switch, and I can just enjoy them from my bedroom, the toilet, or my office.
Long live handheld gaming.
Yes. Viva la revolution.
Let's move on and thank our sponsors. And Gamers Week podcast is, of course, proudly sponsored by the Retro Game Club podcast. It's a fantastic, family-friendly retro gaming podcast. In each episode, Rob and Hugh pick two games to play and discuss, as well as news, interviews, and other topics. They just released their episode 115, where they talk about MAME turning 25 and making video calls on the Game Boy Advance. Visit RetroGameClub.net to check them out or follow the link in the show notes.
Wow, MAME turned 25. We are old, officially.
You needed that to tell you were old?
Well, Contra turned 35. MAME turns there.
There's just reminders right and left.
I got my own mortality staring me in the face.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's like every time you turn around, you're just getting punched in the face again. All right, let's move on to our main topic for the evening. Ryan, will you start us off?
Sure thing. From Business Insider, 8 video game movies in the works after Uncharted. As Hollywood looks to supercharge streaming services, more and more video games are getting the TV treatment, from Netflix Assassin's Creed to HBO's The Last of Us. Game-based movies, on the other hand, have a long history of commercial and critical failure. But while the latest video game movie, Uncharted, flopped with critics, receiving a 40% Rotten Tomatoes critic score, is off to a solid start with audiences. It has a 90% audience score on Rotten Tomatoes, and it topped the box office over the holiday weekend with $51 million.
Holiday weekend?
Yeah.
Holiday.
President's Day?
Okay.
Yep. Moving on.
That doesn't usually register in my mind as a holiday.
Uncharted and other recent game-based movie hits like Detective Pikachu and Sonic the Hedgehog suggest that there's still gas left in the tank for big screen video game adaptations. At least that's what Hollywood is hoping, as a handful of high-profile video game movies are coming soon or are in the works.
An adaptation of Ubisoft's 2003 game Beyond Good and Evil, about a photojournalist who uncovers an alien invasion, is in the works for Netflix. It will be directed by Rob Letterman, who made another recent video game movie, Detective Pikachu, as well as animated movies like Monsters vs. Aliens and Shark Tale.
Oof.
I liked those two movies. I'm going to
really?
Say guilty pleasure. Monster versus Aliens was fantastic, but that's because of like Seth Rogen and the guy mm-hmm. who plays House. Those guys were awesome. Shark Tale, it was all Will Smith. Everything else out of that movie sucked.
So you guys don't even like these two movies. You don't like the movies. You just like the actors in them.
I think there's you can like an entire movie, or you can like someone in the movie and still have fun and entertainment, is what right. I'm gonna say.
That's fine, but that guy didn't make the actors, he made the movies.
That's fair. So as long as you got a good casting director, these might have a chance.
Next up, Hostel director Eli Roth is making a Borderlands movie based on the Gearbox and 2K game of the same name, about a group of vault hunters in search of the infamous vault that contains alien technology. It's in post-production and is set to be released by the studio Lionsgate. Kate Blanchett is starring.
I gotta say, I'm glad that they picked somebody who directed more of like a scary movie than the guy who probably directed like Frozen for Borderlands. So I get it. I get where they're going with this.
The Borderlands games are so visually unique. And mm-hmm. also the writing is really dark, but it can be really funny as well. So I feel like this has a chance to be a good movie. Has a chance.
They all have chances.
Well, they do they? I'm looking we'll down ahead at this,
yeah, I was gonna
this
say.
Rich one. I'm going, I don't think so, but we'll get to that in a second. I think this has an above average chance to actually be a good movie.
All right, next up is Sony is developing a movie based on the 2020 PlayStation exclusive game, Ghosts of Tsushima, about a samurai warrior defending his home during the Mongol invasion. Chad Stahelski, who directed the John Wick movies, is set to direct. I am super excited for this. I am obsessed with like feudal Japan history and lore, and turning that into a John Wick movie is awesome. And Blue, I know you are even more excited than I am.
Well, hey, I have a game you should play then.
I have yet to play this game, and I want to so badly.
Oh, I got the platinum for Ghost of Tsushima. It's actually a very reasonable platinum to get. Beautiful game, so much fun, very cinematic. I can see where the story should translate well to screen. You know, as always, there's a bit of risk, but the fight choreography in the John Wick movies is killer, of course. So
for sure,
this could be a really, really visually stunning movie, and I hope that it doesn't get studioed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right.
If they just stay true to the game, it should be good.
Up next, a Just Dance movie. Huh?
Yeah. Yep.
That's the one we were talking about.
I see Channing Tatum, or what is that his name? Channing Tatum? Yeah.
No, we're going to go with Channing Tatum.
It's got to be starring Channing Tatum, because I mean, he does the whole step up and dance your ass off and Magic Mike and all that stuff. And he's got to be.
He's getting a little old, though.
Yeah. He probably still has it.
How old is he?
He's got to be in his 40s.
That's old.
Yeah, that's super old. Okay, he's 41. He's the same age as me.
So do you have moves like Jagger?
Admittedly, I do not, but I don't think that has anything to do with my age.
I don't anymore with these knees.
That's the point I'm trying to get at, is that, you know, the stuff starts to creak when you get into your 40s.
Ubisoft Film and TV, a division of the gaming company Ubisoft, confirmed to Insider that the movie about the video game is still in the works and that the company is developing an idea with producer Will Gluck, who directed the Peter Rabbit movies. The movie is set up at Sony's Screen Gems. Exactly.
Now, of course, the Just Dance video games sell every year they come out, so there's definitely an audience for people who enjoy the games. I just don't know if that translates well over to a movie.
I don't think it will.
So the movie is just everybody in the audience get up and start doing these moves.
I mean, it's the same premise if somebody made a Tetris movie.
They are making a Tetris movie.
The history of Tetris.
Yeah, that's different. Like if they decided to make some, I don't know how would they incorporate Tetris into a movie, but whatever they did, if it wasn't a documentary, don't do it.
Okay, next up, Metal Gear Solid is in the works from Sony and Kong Skull Island director Jordan Voight Roberts, with Oscar Isaac set to star as the character Solid Snake. Details have been limited. There was a squee. But Voight Roberts has been trying to get the movie off the ground for several years. At the gaming conference E3 last year, the director described his vision as wanting to create a new type of action on screen that also is based in the quietness of the stealth of the games. Huh. That's an interesting challenge.
Right. Poe Dameron going to be the quiet one.
Well, I mean, he was also Apocalypse in one of the X-Men movies.
That's true. That's true.
So I'm interested to see. I mean, he definitely has a Solid Snake type look to him. So I think they could do wonders with this. If it's going to be a franchise, I don't know if it's going to be a movie or if it's going to be a series. But I, for one, am looking forward to it.
Well, you know, they'll franchise the hell out of it if they can, if they think they can.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think they'll keep the crazy plot?
Can you?
maybe with some of the stuff in the first game, not the original Metal Gear, but the Metal Gear Solid from the PlayStation. I think they could. I think they could definitely do something along those lines, where like a rogue team goes in and tries to steal something, and it's your biological brother as opposed to a clone.
But if you take the clones out,
I know. If you take the clones out, then you don't have a. The fans will riot. Exactly. Yeah. And they'll write stern letters and say, well, you got to put this back in here. And they'll like, oh, okay. All right. You got us. We'll put it in.
And it'll be like the Sonic movie all over again.
If they show me a box moving through the level,
that's all in the
movie,
need.
I'm good. I'm good.
Speaking of Sonic.
Yeah.
Paramount's Sonic the Hedgehog was one of the biggest movies of 2020 with $149 million domestically and $320 million worldwide. It was released before theaters were shut down due to the coronavirus pandemic, and also the highest grossing video game movie of all time at the U.S. box office. On April 8th, Paramount will release the sequel to theaters, and I'm sure Games with Coffee just squeed.
I didn't see the first one. I assume you guys did.
Really? I did.
No, I didn't see it.
I saw it with my kids. They enjoyed it. I thought it was done nicely. It wasn't the greatest movie, but Jim Carrey actually played a pretty good Dr. Robotnik. It was what it was. It wasn't great. It wasn't movie of the year, but it was fun.
Which is, up until this point, has been good enough for a video game movie.
Right, right.
I watched the whole thing. Best video game movie ever.
As long as it was decent, then I think that you can call that a win in a video game adaptation.
For sure. And now this next one is going to have a few different characters, if memory serves me right. Tails, I think, is in this one, as well as Knuckles, potentially.
Yep.
So that's kind of a cool addition. I'm glad that they're adding more. And that also opens up the door for later adaptations with additional characters, even characters from non-video game versions of Sonic. There was a lot of cartoons out there and stuff that had some additional characters that would definitely translate well to a movie space. So glad that they're continuing to make these, especially for Sega fans who haven't had a lot to celebrate in the last couple of decades. So that's awesome.
Do you think Sega fans are waiting for a Streets of Rage movie adaptation?
Oh, that would be great, man.
That's an idea.
Didn't say it was a good one. Just said that's an idea.
I didn't say it was a bad one either. I said it's an idea.
We're giving away these ideas away for free.
I've seen the Double Dragon movie, so if it's anything like that, you're all screwed.
Animation studio Illumination and gaming company Nintendo are making an animated Super Mario Brothers movie. The voice cast includes Chris Pratt as Mario, Charlie Day as Luigi, Anya Taylor-Joy as Princess Peach, Jack Black as Bowser, Seth Rogen as Donkey Kong, and Keegan-Michael Key as Toad. Dear God.
This cast right here is what happens when a movie is studioed to death.
Yes, and I think they're all going to sit around and get high, and that's what's going to bring out probably some of the best voices for this thing, but I'm not hopeful.
Seth Rogen and Jack Black? No.
I like Seth Rogen. I'm sorry. I like Jack Black as Bowser. I think he's could be wild and crazy, but I mean, Chris Pratt as Mario? What are you doing?
I don't know.
I will say there was a lot of people that were like, why aren't we bringing Charles Martinet into this one? And admittedly, I would love to have him voice stuff, but let's be honest, when it comes to Mario, 2 hours or an hour and a half of It's-a-me, a Mario, that might be a little too much.
Which actually I think is reason number one why we probably don't need a full-length Super Mario Brothers movie.
You bring up an excellent point.
I mean, that is Mario's canonical voice. If you created a character who can only be handled in small doses, then why are we making a two-hour movie?
That is the question. I mean, I could only handle Captain Lou Albano's voice back in the 90s, like for like a very small amount.
Which he was only in small sections of
that
show, right? It sucked. Hey, paisanos!
Yeah.
Do all the Mario! I mean,
there's nothing wrong with that. Right. Everybody did the Mario and had a good time and went on with their lives.
The one thing, though, Keegan-Michael Key is Toad. I'm actually excited about that. I like Keegan-Michael Key.
Me too.
He did a voice for a few or at least one episode of Rick and Morty that was really, really well done. So I'm excited to see him as Toad, because other adaptations of Toad have been less than stellar. So Clearly, he's not going to be like, "Hi, Mario," the entire
yeah,
time.
Yeah, that's another canonical voice that nobody can handle for 2 hours. So
exactly.
And then I told him, "You were in another castle."
Just please don't take the hat off. Please don't take the hat
off. Nightmare fuel.
All right, last up, a sequel to 2018's Tomb Raider reboot starring Alicia Vikander as Lara Croft is in the works. Few details have been announced aside from Misha Green, the creator of HBO's Lovecraft Country, stepping in to direct last year.
Did you guys see the 2018 Tomb Raider?
Yes.
No.
Thoughts?
It was very watchable. It was not without its faults. For example, I think it made her a little bit too passive. There's too many times where she relies on somebody else to save her, which I didn't think was a very Lara Croft thing to do. But, you know, like we've talked about before, putting it side by side with a lot of other video game adaptations, especially the previous Tomb Raider movies, it's extremely watchable. Extremely watchable.
So I'm guessing you're going to say that Angelina Jolie did not do a good job of playing Lara Croft.
I think she actually probably did a pretty good job of playing the Lara Croft from the early games, but the movies were just not well done, not well executed, not well written, nothing.
Her faux English accent was atrocious in those movies.
Yeah.
That's one where, like, you hear it and it's all you pay attention to the entire movie, and I can't get past it.
Whoa, so, but it does have Daniel Craig in a shower scene. Just throwing it out there.
There it is.
Hoop, there it is. Sprinkles. I liked at the time, you know, I think that was, I'm infatuated with Angelina Jolie. So I like mm-hmm. most men were. And then you thrust her into a role like this, Lara Croft. Yeah. Where it's somebody that many a prepubescent and teenage boy had fallen in love with whenever Tomb Raider came out back in the mid 90s. Even when you didn't get to see a lot. I mean, we a lot was left to our imagination.
But you kept looking for the code.
You did keep looking for the code.
The new code.
Yes, yes. Like, oh my God, it's real. I got to see it. But I liked Angelina Jolie's take on Lara Croft, especially the first movie. The second movie wasn't that great, but still watchable in my opinion.
When the Tomb Raider sequel comes to Netflix or something, I'll probably give it a chance. But
yeah, there you go.
Not rushing out to the theater to see many of these, probably with the exception maybe being the Ghost of Tsushima movie.
It's actually what I was going to ask. Out of all of these, which one are you most excited? Blue, I assume Ghost of Tsushima.
Ghost of Tsushima.
I'm with you on that. I'm also super excited. That's probably my pick. Donnie, Just Dance, right?
I mean, top.
Only if it's somebody in their 40 is starring.
Good old Tanning Chatham. Right.
So Ghosts of Tsushima, from what I've seen of the video game, it looks stellar. I can only imagine the translation to film, how this is going to work. I think they've got a softball sitting there in front of them. All they got to do is hit a home run. Metal Gear Solid, very hopeful for that, but also very fearful that they could screw things up. Now, surprisingly, one of the things that wasn't talked about here was the fact that BioShock. Netflix is
Business Insider dropping the ball here.
Right. Now, BioShock is one of my favorite games of all time, and it is a beloved franchise. And that is something that I think will bring out the pitchforks and the torches if you do the wrong thing with it.
Well, I know that, like, for example, with BioShock Infinite, there are some things that they probably could not put in a movie.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Topics and themes and things that would not
Won't play well, definitely.
Right.
Right. But the original BioShock, where you're in Rapture, underwater, dealing with splicers and collecting Adam and the little sisters and the big daddies. Absolutely. I think you could, there's so much that you could do in real life or on the big screen that I'm hyped. I'm hyped for it.
Yeah, make it like it's an alien, the movie Aliens, where it's, you know, that really dark theme, yep, and every, you know, it's around every corner and there's not a moment of, you know, a lapse in suspense. I think if you could pull that off, that would do well and serve a great franchise for sure.
Well, agreed. I mean, you do need some lapses in suspense. Otherwise, you just have the second Indiana Jones movie. Temple of Doom, is important.
You watch your mouth.
You heard what I said, and I stand by it.
Those are fight words.
I'm going to side with Blue on this one.
It's okay, Donnie.
I will collect myself and reserve from saying any expletives for that.
You cannot float down the side of a mountain in a raft.
I know you can't. But that's only like one of the things.
Or out of a plane. A plane will not save you if you are in an inflatable raft when you hit the side of a mountain. That's all I'm going to say.
Oh, okay. But you can sit in a pit of snakes without a single one of them touching you. Give me a break.
It's just probability at that point.
Actually, you could probably, depending on the type of snake.
Oh,
asps, very dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's what they were full of. So don't give me that crap.
Just saying. Let's move on then. Class time is in session. It is now time for Gaming History 101 with Professor Rybread.
All right, thank you for coming, students. Please take your seats. Welcome back to Professor Rybread's Gaming History 101. And have you ever found yourself struggling to beat a game and wish you had more lives or could jump higher or maybe skip to the next level? Well, in today's lesson, we will be covering the history of cheat codes and cheating devices. So the question is, why cover this for today? So for one, this week is the 35th anniversary of the Nintendo game Contra, which has one of the most widely known cheat codes of all time. And secondly, cheating is bad, but if you're looking to be able to but if you're looking to be able to learn a game or experience it in a new way for your own personal enjoyment, cheat codes and cheating devices can be a lot of fun. So before we dive into this, have you guys ever used either a cheat code or a cheating device?
I never.
Whoa, never.
That's a bold statement.
Just kidding.
So let's go ahead and start at the beginning. So I did a lot of digging to try to find what the first official cheat code was. And that information, unfortunately, seems to be lost to time. However, the consensus is that early cheat codes were created in the early 1980s by game developers in order to make a game easier to get through so that they didn't waste time while they were testing. So imagine having to play through a game an entire time at the difficulty that would be expected of gamers to try to just test one piece of it. So making it a little bit easier for yourself or being able to skip levels was an important way to make sure the game was playable and that you could test bugs. So the point was, though, that often these were never meant to be discovered by the public. Due to time restrictions, many of them were never removed. So the interesting part is that people found these, even though they weren't intended to use them. Basically, they would require inputs that no normal person, at least they would suspect, would stumble onto. An example of that is the game Manic Miner, where the level select code was 603-1769, which was developer Matthew Smith's driver's license number.
Oh, oops.
Yeah. So hopefully nobody ever stumbled onto that before his license expired. But nonetheless, again, they were always kind of personalized to the developer. But eventually, cheat codes became common knowledge amongst gamers. On some of the most popular games out there, there were cheat codes available. And the most popular one, I think, from history is the Konami code, or some people refer to it as the Contra code. Now, interestingly enough, it wasn't first used as the 30 life code in Contra. Do you guys know which game it was?
Gradius.
Correct. Yep. In 86, Hashimoto, who was the developer of Gradius, was porting it over to the NES, but found the game way too difficult. So rather than making it easier, like changing the game to make it easier for players, he basically put in the 30 life code so he could just test it, more or less. So the code has at this point become part of the zeitgeist. And it's so popular, it's often a rite of passage for retro gamers to have it memorized and has been paid homage to in other games, you know, even movies and TV shows. So do you have it memorized?
Of course.
Yes.
What is the Konami code?
Up, up, down, down, left, right, BA.
Beautiful.
Wrong.
Oh, go. What is it?
Up, up, down, down, left, right, BA, start.
Correct. I just got actually'd.
Actually.
But there are plenty of other examples of popular cheat codes out there. So, for example, with Doom, there's the IDKFA, which is all keys and weapons. Ikari Warriors, if you type in ABBA on the NES version, it will revive you after dying. Sonic 2, which is another example of a personal one, was 1965-09-17, which was Yuji Naka's birthday, unlocks the level select screen in Sonic 2. Of course, you've got Donkey Kong Country, the barrel, B-A-R-R-A-L, gives you 50 lives. Sega's Mortal Kombat was A-B-A-C-A-B-B, which was...
The blood code.
The blood code. So if you wanted to see blood on the screen, you could type this in there. So, and then finally, of course, Mike Tyson's Punch Out. I don't know if I would call this a cheat code or a password, but definitely puts you into the hardest part of the game, which of course is 007-373-5963. I do have that one memorized.
Same here.
So eventually this turned into an entire industry when it comes to cheat codes. You know, there were magazines, books, even TV shows that were created solely around providing users tips, tricks, cheat codes to their favorite games. And a lot of us probably learned about cheat codes from friends on the playground, right? During recess. Mm-hmm. I know, for example, I went down to the pool club I used to go to. My cousin was there to get the Doom cheat codes.
To get the scoop.
Right, to get the scoop, writing them down on a sheet of paper, and then running home and playing some Doom with the God code. So, interestingly enough, cheat codes at first were ways for developers to get through games so they could test them, and eventually became part of the whole gaming experience. Which leads to our last topic, cheating devices. So the most popular of which was the Game Genie. Did either of you own a Game Genie?
No.
I never owned one as a child. I do have one for the Sega Genesis currently. And I've really only used a Game Genie like once or twice. And the times that I tried to use it, it wasn't working properly.
You know, and it's not a great piece of hardware. There are a lot of bugs with it. There, if I remember right, too, a Game Genie came in the code book with instructions on how to potentially make your own codes. So the one thing that was nice about it, though, is that it would only stay for that game. So you couldn't ruin a game if you put it in a code that broke everything. All you had to do was just unplug it and try again. I owned a Game Genie as a kid.
Yeah, that sounds like a rich kid thing.
And I used it to get through Battletoads because that was a game that I struggled with a whole lot. So I used to use the level skip stuff to get to the next level for Battletoads. Never actually beat it, but Game Genie at least let me see more of the game. But the Game Genie itself was actually developed in 1990 from a British company called Codemasters. You might be familiar with them for things like the Aladdin Deck Enhancer or the Quattro games. They were involved with that as well. Basically, they created the Game Genie as quote unquote a game enhancer, not a cheat device, but a game enhancer.
Right.
Right. And it would come out for not only the NES, but the Super Nintendo. There's the one for the Genesis Mega Drive, Game Boy, and Game Gear even got one. I had a Game Boy Game Genie, and that thing is a honking piece of technology. And the code book in the back is this little tiny, you know, you'd have to read it with like a microscope in order to pick out the codes. But basically, it was like an inch by half an inch rectangle. And it was probably about an inch and a half thick, too. And it's stored in this little like pocket in the back of the Game Genie. But eventually what ended up happening is that they were sold in Canada and the U.S., but by different companies. So Canada got or was sold by the company Comerica. They took the rights for it. And in the United States, it was Galoob. Now, the interesting part about it is that with Comerica, after a while, they had kind of recognized that Galoob was pretty much the powerhouse when it came to selling this stuff. So they stopped making the Comerica version of the Game Genie in Canada, and it switched over to Galoob, which is why most people, if you, you know, take a look at your Game Genie right now, more than likely it's going to say Galoob on it. If it says Comerica, you actually have one that's fairly rare. So I've got one that says Comerica because I know Clayman. I know Clayman, a good friend of ours, who is from Canada, and he sent me one. And the cool part is that the code book comes in half English, half French, which is kind of cool.
You got some learning to do.
Right. Well, thankfully, it's still in English. So now, Nintendo was not a fan of the
game. I imagine not.
No. They even sued both Comerica and Galoob. Howard Lincoln of Nintendo America was quoted as saying, "It created derivative works. It not only alters Nintendo games, infringing on copyrights, but can make them less fun, too easy to play." Now, interestingly enough, though, Nintendo lost those lawsuits. A lot of it had to do with the fact that they were claiming that it was a derivative work. And the law said that a derivative work has to be able to stand on its own. And with the Game Genie, you can't play the games without utilizing the NES. So it's not a standalone thing. This is just, you know, fair use, if you will. But interestingly, and to kind of note here, the NES 2 or the top loader was designed in such a way where a typical Game Genie would not fit in it.
Ah.
Yeah. Coincidence? I'll let you decide. Here it is. But to kind of wrap things up, cheating for personal enjoyment is part of the gaming experience, or at least it has become that way. So even though cheat codes have been more or less eclipsed at this point by microtransactions in games, in order to find new stuff, you got to pay for it, unfortunately, with modern games, it's still a part of the gaming community. And even nowadays, there's competitions that use codes to make games more challenging. For example, there is one where you can use the Game Genie to play the Hammer Mario version of it, where all bad guys throw hammers. So it adds additional challenge.
Yep. Why would you want to do that?
Oh, I've seen Hungry Gorilla and Red Ox and a few others on Twitch go through this, and it is a gauntlet. Trust me, it's ridiculous. So if memory serves me right, you pick infinite lives and then you throw in that thing, and then it's a lot of it's luck too. It's based off of like what frames you got going, whole thing. But if you want to challenge yourself, the opportunity is out there.
And, not like that.
Right. And the thing is, though, cheat codes and you know, cheating devices are have given gamers a new life on games that they've enjoyed in the past. So thank you all for attending today's lesson. Just a reminder, if you have any ideas for a story you'd like to hear us talk about on the podcast, message gamersweekpodcast@gmail.com, and we might feature your suggestion. And a big thank you to Jordan Breeding of Ranker.com and Norm Caruso of the Gaming Historian YouTube channel for much of the information covered for today.
Norm!
Norm's awesome.
All right. Thank you, Professor. Let's go ahead and wrap up this episode. Thank you for listening to episode 10 of Gamers Week podcast. And a big thank you to the Retro Game Club podcast for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget to check out their links in the show notes below. If you want to connect with Gamers Week, you can follow us on Twitter at Gamers Week PC. Email us at gamersweekpodcast@gmail.com. Check us out on Twitch at twitch.tv/gamersweekpodcast. Visit our merch store at gamers-week-podcast.creator-spring.com. Or if you want to do it the easy way, follow the link in the show notes. And you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/gamersweek. Finally, since you made it all the way to the end of this episode, please leave us a rating and a review to let us know how we did. We really do value your feedback. And while you're there, consider subscribing on iTunes, Spotify, or your podcast platform of choice. That is it for us today. And we will be back with you next week, except for without Ryan.
Which will make it an awesome episode.
Finally class up the place, right?
I know, geez.
See you in 2 weeks, guys.
Good night, everybody.
Bye.